Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome back. We took a break last week. So good to be back. Just to note that this series called Foundational Principles, based on the book, Witness, is going to go, that's today, another 2 weeks. So we're going to go for another 2 weeks and then take a short break and then come back with a new series. Until the end of the term, we're keeping on Zoom. And we'll see what happens after that. Okay, so we're going through a series called Foundational Principles, based on the book called The Witness by Ariel Berger, which is lessons from Elie Wiesel's classroom. And it's got seven concepts, seven chapters. And we've been going through one each week. Today's topic, which is called activism, it really in some ways is a continuation of what we talked about last time, which was madness and rebellion. So just quickly, a short review. We talked about the concept of recognizing madness in the world, evil, insanity, and so on. Never normalizing something that is evil, and particularly insanely evil. The second was the concept of rebelling against insanity. In other words, the prohibition of silence. Not remaining silent. We discussed this at length about often evil grows and evil is nurtured and evil expands because people are silent. And the third idea, which we touched on, was this concept of fighting madness with madness. And it's what Elie Wiesel refers to as mystical madness, which is super rational conviction, strength, determination, and so on. So, as I said, today's topic, or today's chapter, which was called Activism, is sort of a continuation. It's almost like a call to action. Once we recognize madness, it's a call to action to do something, about evil, hatred, intolerance, bloodshed, negativity, aggression, and so on. And that's why it's called activism. In other words, it's a call for people to become activists, really, and to stand up and to do something about evil in the world, about intolerance, racism, hatred, and just general division and disunity and so on. So before we explore some of the concepts in the chapter, I want to just make a couple of comments. First of all, this was the next chapter, but unfortunately it's a little bit relevant, actually, quite on a global level, on an international level. It's something which we can also tie into what's going on now in America, unfortunately, which is very, very sad, and it's sad on two levels. It's sad because people find it very difficult to discern and to be nuanced about this. But two things are true. One thing is that there was a act of racism and hate, from all accounts, brutality, by a policeman, by a bad apple, I suppose you can call him, and was condemned by all sides of the political divide. But sadly, what's happened is there's been a senseless response of destruction, violence, criminal behavior, which is not helping and it's just harmful. And we need to talk about that. Why is it happening? And we'll talk about that a little bit because it's relevant to each of us, really. And we'll talk about it in context of today's discussion. The second thing I want to just expand on a bit before we talk about the actual topic, I want to go back to front and talk about something that the author talks about at the end of the chapter. And I'm doing this because when I started reading this chapter on activism, I thought to myself, how's this really going to fit into the Thursday morning session? And I'll tell you why I asked that, because we get together on a Thursday morning and really this is a personal growth session where we talk about what each of us can do to accomplish, to grow, to achieve as human beings. How can we take the next step? How can we become better people? How can we inspire others and so on? One thing is clear, we can't all become Elie Wiesels, right? We can't all become activists on that level. We're not Nobel Prize winners necessarily. He was someone who was a Nobel Prize winner. He traveled to war-torn regions all over the world where genocide and human rights violations were happening in such a terrible way. He traveled there. He used his experience to speak out on a very global level. He lobbied politicians and urged leaders of countries to intervene and to do something about it, and often he was successful, and he made a very, very big difference on a global international stage, right? So I was thinking, what does it have to do with each of us? So I think in order to answer that question, before we talk about the actual topic, is to go back to front and to talk about something at the end of the chapter. And at the end of the chapter, there's a piece, or a few pages, I should say, where the author of the book, Ariel Berger, observes how Elie Wiesel, when he was urging everyone to become, to stand up and to be an activist and to stand up for human rights and dignity and tolerance and eliminating hatred in the world and so on and so forth, he observed that actually it had quite a powerful impact. In fact, many students of Elie Wiesel's classroom changed their career paths as a result, and they took up positions of leadership, whether it be priests or pastors or imam or whatever the case was, and they did it to help other people, and they did that, by accounts that they reported back later, with conviction, with hope, with determination, absorbing all the lessons that Elie Wiesel had in fact taught them. And I'm just going to quote a little bit from the book just as an example, and also how this plays out and how it answers the question that I've just shared with you. He says, another student, Muhammad, went back to native Pakistan to work for human rights, especially those of women targeted by their own families. A 14-year-old rape victim threatened by her parents with stoning. A woman blinded an acid attack, a survivor of an honor-killing attempt. So Muhammad tries to help them. He wrote to Professor Wiesel over many years with questions and seeking encouragement as he endangered his life helping women at risk. In one letter he wrote, I am able to help a handful of women and girls, but I can do nothing to change the reality here. It is hard, and I'm trying never to give up. Your words against despair are helping me. And then the author, as he observes all of this, he makes the following observation. He says that when he saw all of this, he said, I felt humbled, even ashamed. Wasn't I equally exposed to Professor Wiesel's message? Didn't I spend even more time with him over the years? Why then did my work remain in the realm of ideas? And he says one day he interrupted a meeting with Professor Wiesel and he said to him that he wants to share his struggle, right? And he said to him like this, he said, I feel like a phony. I study and teach about humanism, yet I myself am not doing anything concrete to help. I don't travel to conflict zones. I don't write op-eds in newspapers. I don't open my home to refugees. I'm trying to understand why and what can I do to change this? So the Elie Wiesel looks at him and he says, first of all, you're being too hard on yourself. You are more engaged in these issues than many people. And teaching is a form of activism. That's first of all, such an important lesson. Teaching, informing, educating other people, inspiring other people in itself is a form of activism. He says, do you think it doesn't make a difference? Each student you touch may work in more concrete ways than you. Yet his or her work will be motivated by your encounters. Don't you understand that? Further on in that chapter, someone says to him, a student, who says to him, it's so overwhelming. How do we choose which issues to address? Whom to help? How to help? Where do we start? Right? So Elie Wiesel turns to that student and says the following. You start where you are, he says, turning his hand palm up. What have you seen? Who are the human beings you pass on the street every day? And he tells a story about a sort of a colleague of his, a friend of his, who was a rabbi. And he says that who's also a head of a seminary. And he says a student arrived one day to that seminary to join the seminary or to enroll in the course of becoming a leader, a spiritual leader, whatever the case was. And the rabbi asks him, how did you get to the building? Listen to this, very interesting. He says, I actually walked. I walked a few miles from West 70th Street to 120th Street. So the rabbi says to him, tell me, did you see the homeless woman on 96th Street? You know, the one with the hand-printed sign and the blankets? Student said, no, I'm sorry, I didn't notice. Then he says, did you see the veteran on 117th? The man with the gray beard and few teeth? He usually wears a baseball cap. The student said, I'm sorry, I actually didn't notice. And he asked him, you know, again, did you see the tall man with, you know, outside the store and so on? And he says he hadn't noticed any of this. So he turns around to him and he says, well, how can you become a leader if you don't see the human beings around you? And he says, and this is what I want to finish with in terms of this section, he says, you don't have to go far away. You just have to notice who is around you in your street, in your family, among your friends. Professor Wiesel continues, what are their needs? What is their pain? It can be small. Modest acts of kindness are more significant than we recognize. It does not have to be newsworthy. You just need to look for the outstretched hand. You need to touch one person every day with compassion. So I say that and I start from that end of the chapter because that's how it is for all of us. In other words, like this. This chapter is about activism, being an activist. But being an activist does not mean, and that's why it's so relevant to all of us, it does not mean on a large scale, changing the world. We don't have to get up every morning and say, how can we change the world? How can we get international attention? How can we make headline news and push a point? Certain people can do that, and that's unbelievable. Elie Wiesel was one of them. But we don't have to do that because it might be implementing activism and helping as a result of that activism one person. It's about noticing. It's about being sensitive to one person at a time. Our rabbis tell us, we've mentioned this many, many times, that every person, every individual is a olam male. It's a full, entire universe. We'll come back to this later. What it really means and what we need to take out of this chapter, which we haven't done the chapter yet, but what we need to take out of the chapter is noticing one person's need, one person's plight, standing up for it, standing up to evil, preventing evil happening to that person, preventing hatred, preventing bullying happening to that person, right? It might mean advocating for one bullied child. It might mean standing up for someone who's abused in a relationship. It might be reaching out to someone who needs mental health support, right? To get them the support. It might mean being proactive and preventative about educating. As we said before, teaching is a form of activism. But it means having it on our minds, and it means talking about these topics. It means educating and inspiring other people to love, to be kind, to have empathy, to have compassion, to talk about the negativity of hate and division and disunity and violence and aggression and bullying and so on and so forth. That's what it means. And I hope that when we talk about these ideas, we can inspire ourselves a little bit to take upon ourselves to notice and to stand up and to do something about some of these things. So we go back then to the beginning of the chapter. You see, because in order to be an activist on a small role, on a small level, like as we can do, often what happens is we need to look at it how it works on a global level. And I think I've explained this before. You know, we often tell stories of great people, right? We tell stories of heroism. We tell stories of people who overcame adversity in the most heroic and resilient way. People who are tremendous activists. People who did amazing things in their life. You know, we watch TED Talks about these people. We listen to podcasts about these people. Amazing stuff. And what is the purpose of it? Is it to copy them? Not necessarily. We can't all copy them. So is it just to think, well, it's a great story, but we can't ever get there? In other words, maybe we can have the opposite effect. We can be overwhelmed or we can just give up, right? And the answer is no. The answer is that we tell these stories to see what it looks like under a magnifying glass, to see what it looks like in big, so that we can learn from it and then apply the relevance to us one step at a time, one person at a time, in our personal environment, right? That's what it means. So let's have a look how it worked with Elie Wiesel and what he talked about. Let's have a look what it looks like on an international level, and let's try then apply it to ourselves. So let's explore a few of the topics in the chapter. Sorry, if you're hearing a bit of noise, it's, I think, a cleaning truck coming by my house. There we are, went away. Okay. So let's understand a few principles. We're going to just try and work through a couple of different principles. Firstly, to tackle hate, to tackle negativity, to tackle disunity and division, we need to understand it. Right? We need to understand it. See, when people are cruel to each other, when people hate each other. Now, notice, I'm not saying when people disagree with each other. Or even, I'm not even saying when people are harsh to each other, because sometimes there's a place for that, as we'll see later. But when people relate to each other with hate, it's never rational. You know, our rabbis tell us that when the Second Temple was destroyed and the Jews were sent into exile, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple was destroyed, our rabbis tell us, because of sinat chinam. Because of baseless, stupid, irrational hatred. And it was so bad that our rabbis tell us that the first temple was destroyed because of very, very serious transgressions like idolatry and adultery and so on. And yet the exile, the Babylonian exile, only lasted for 70 years. Whereas the second temple was because of baseless hate, and we're still in exile. Now, what does it mean, sinat chinam? What does baseless hatred mean? No normal person will answer a question like this. In other words, if you say to a certain person, why do you hate that person? Why are you cruel to that person? They will never say, I don't know, just because. They'll never do that. They'll rationalize it. They'll give you a reason. They'll say, do you know what that person did to me? They'll say, do you know what kind of person it is? Do you know what kind of ideas that person has? Do you know what kind of values that person has? We need to eradicate. We need to fight against it. And so on and so forth. Right? So what does it mean to have sinat chinam? To have means sinat chinam means, baseless hatred means actually not to find hatred that is baseless. It's the other way around. Baseless hatred actually means to understand that every hatred, hate in general, hatred to people I'm talking about, right? Not hatred to evil. Hatred to evil is a good thing. Hatred to true evil. But when you express hatred towards another, and therefore you humiliate another person or you compromise their dignity, it is always baseless. Or almost always baseless. Because 9 times out of 10, it's an expression of our own ego and our own insecurity and an inability to make room for the other. There was a great essay written by Shalom Dov Ber Schneerson, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe's father, where he talks about, he says that most hatred begins with intolerance, the inability to make space for that person because I feel threatened or I feel attacked or I feel competition, I feel jealous, whatever the case is, which is all expression of my own insecurity or my own ego or the same thing. And therefore, I just can't tolerate the person. I clash with that person. You know how people say, you know, that person rubs me up the wrong way. It just rubs me up the wrong way. What really are we saying, and we all say this at some degree, what we're really saying is I have a big ego, which we all have, and this person sort of tickles that ego, and this person sort of clashes with that ego, right? Now, no one's going to admit, or most people don't admit, that I hate the other person, or I'm irritated by the other person, or I'm intolerant to the other person just because they're threatening me and they're undermining my ego. So therefore, post-fact, I have to come up with a rationalization. So therefore, we come up with a whole reason why we hate that person. But I think the depth of the Talmud telling us that the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, was destroyed because of baseless hatred, is teaching us not because there was baseless hatred, but because there was hatred, and hatred is always baseless. Right? Now, this is true with global hatred, right? The kind of things that is discussed in this book and the type of stuff that Elie Wiesel got involved in, like things like Cambodia or Bosnia, Darfur, and so on and so forth. Right, where there's genocides and genocides that come from pure hatred, and we need to recognize it, and we need to call it out, but we need to call out every hatred, and this is where the relevance to us is. We need to call out within ourselves, and we need to call out when we see with others hatred being expressed. It can be small scale hatred, it can be undermining a person. Now, there's plenty of room in the world. We've talked about this many times. Difference is a good thing. Conflicting ideas is a good thing. Disagreement is a good thing. In relationships, there should be disagreement. There should be conflict. But when there's hatred, meaning any form of hatred, or disunity, or disrespect, whether it's global or it is individual, that needs to be called out. And what do I mean by when I say hatred? Hatred means anything that expresses itself not with disagreement, not even with being firm and assertive, but it expresses itself by compromising the dignity of another, or senseless violence, or aggression, or bullying for personal gain. That's when you know that it's hatred, and it's baseless, and it's senseless. You know, the let's go back to the story, this concept. I shared this idea many, many years ago, so many of you weren't there and probably won't remember. And those that do, apologies for the revision, but it's a beautiful idea. When the Talmud tells us that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, It bases it on a story. I'll just say briefly, I know many of you know the story, but let me just say it briefly again. The story is about two individuals. The Talmud says that because of two individuals called Kamtza and Bar Kamtza, the temple was destroyed. What's the story? Briefly, the story is there was a person who had a friend, a very close friend. He was called Kamtza. And he had an enemy, someone he couldn't stand, someone that rubbed him up the wrong way, someone that he was completely hated. And his name was Bar Kamtza. And this individual, who we don't even know his name, threw a party. Social distancing wasn't an issue then, so he threw a party. And he sent his attendant, he sent his person with him to go and invite Kamtza. And the guy made a mistake, a typo. Instead of typing Kamtza on the invitation, he typed Bar Kamtza. Bar Kamtza gets the invitation. He thought, wow, my enemy's making peace. That's so nice. What a great gesture. And he comes to the party. The host walks in and he sees his enemy Bar Kamtza and he screams at him. He says, get out in front of everyone. And the guy was so humiliated. He says, please don't humiliate me. I promise you I'll pay for my meal. And he says, I don't care. Get out. He says, I promise you I'll pay for half the function. Caterers are not cheap. I'll pay, just don't embarrass me. He says, get out. He says, I promise you I'll pay the bill for the entire function. He says, I don't care, get out. And he was embarrassed, and there were Jewish leaders sitting there who didn't call it out, who didn't say anything. He didn't speak up because this guy who made the party was a big shot. And they didn't stand up and they didn't speak out, and this guy left humiliated and embarrassed, and he went to the Roman regime and he placed a libel on the Jewish people, and that brought about the destruction of Jerusalem. Senseless hate. He doesn't have to be a friend of the person. He doesn't have to be. He could be an enemy of the person. He can not like the person. He cannot mean to invite. You don't have to invite everyone to your party. But if the guy comes and he's going to be humiliated, don't humiliate the person. He's such an enemy that you can't even tolerate him sitting in the room. That's senseless hatred. But you know where it comes from? In this Talmud, we see a beautiful idea, because the commentaries ask the question. Why does the Talmud say that it was a result of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza that Jerusalem was destroyed? First of all, it wasn't Kamtza's fault anyway. Kamtza was the friend and he'd never got invited by mistake. He wasn't even on the scene. And in fact, it wasn't even Bar Kamtza's fault. He got humiliated. Okay, maybe he shouldn't have gone to the Romans, but he did. Really, it was the fault of the person, the host. We don't even know his name. And we kind of put the whole blame on Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. But there's many explanations. One of the deep thoughts behind it is this. The word Kamtza actually has a translation. And let me take you through this because it's fascinating. The word Kamtza comes from the translation, it's an Aramaic word. And where do we find this Aramaic word? So let me just take you for a moment, if you can just stay with me, to a story in the Chumash, where the spies are sent by Moses to spy out the land of Israel. It's coming up a few weeks' time in the parasha. And they come back with a very negative report. And one of the things they say, that we saw giants there. We saw giants. And we were so small that in their eyes, we were like grasshoppers because we were so small compared to them. So first of all, how did they know that they were looked upon like grasshoppers? So the secret is because they add one more sentence. They said, when we went to Israel and we saw these giants, we were like grasshoppers in their eyes. The chen hayinu be'einenu, and that's the way we felt. We felt like grasshoppers. Someone else looks at you as a grasshopper when you look at yourself as a grasshopper, right? So the grasshopper there was a symbol of we were inferior. We felt weak. We felt we cannot do this. We didn't feel confident. We were insecure. So the grasshopper symbol there is a symbol of insecurity, which is related to ego, as we've talked about many, many times. On the Chumash, there's a famous translation. If you ever looked at a Chumash in Shul, you'll see it on the side. It's called Targum. Targum is an Aramaic translation written by one of the great sages of the Talmud. And the Talmud tells us it was written with divine inspiration. It was a translation into Aramaic. And in Aramaic, when he sees the word chagavim, grasshoppers, he translates it as kamtzin, same word as kamtza. So the Talmud says that Jerusalem was destroyed because of baseless hate. And you know where baseless hate comes from? Kamtsa bar kamtsa. It comes from, not the people kamtsa bar kamtsa. It comes from the attitude. People who had ego. People were insecure. People couldn't make space for others. And when you can't make space for others and other people's values, other people's opinions, you start to become intolerant. Intolerant breeds aggression. Aggression breeds violence and compromise of other people's humility and senseless acts of aggression. That's why the temple was destroyed. That's hate, and that needs to be called out. The Jewish leaders sitting there, unfortunately, didn't call it out. They didn't stand up and say to the host, leave him, it's okay, we'll put up with him it doesn't have to be anyone's friend, but we'll put up with him. No, they didn't do that. They allowed the host to go and humiliate him, and that was a terrible, terrible thing. And I want to just bring this, I think following on from that, is this idea. We need to understand what hatred looks like. We also need to understand that you can't fight hate with hate. And this is what makes the situation now in America so sad. And it makes it so sad because it's an indictment of what is going on in society generally today. Where there's an incredible, and often in the name of tolerance, by the way, there's an incredible culture of intolerance and hatred. So there needs to be a bit of nuance, and two things can be true at the same time. There was a senseless act, a racist act, perpetrated by a policeman. Great, most policemen are great, but perpetrated by a policeman that was a racist. There's nothing else, there's no way else to describe it, according to the pictures we see, right? But you can't fight hatred with hatred and violence. And I don't know why, but people seem to find it very difficult to condemn both things. Both things are wrongs. Two wrongs don't make a right. And it's so sad when you see a decline of society, when you see dysfunction happening, where hatred is called out, but it's fought with equal hatred. Kamtsa bar kamtsa, because everyone is insecure and everyone is intolerant and everyone is hating, and it's only a few individuals who are standing up and saying this has to stop. Yes, we have to call out racism and hatred, but we have to also fight it with words, with education, with standing up, with punishing those that need to be punished, and so on. Justice needs to prevail, but you can't fight hatred with hatred. The result is that there's a culture of hatred, total decline of society, and on a global level just declines and evolves into absolute dysfunction and violence and criminality and so on and so forth. So what do we do about it? Right? So what do we do about it? So one of the questions that's asked to Elie Wiesel in the classroom, he's asked the question and he says, someone asks, he says, if we really want to transform hate, where do we start? To which Elie Wiesel answers and he says the following. He says, I've spent many years asking that question. Hatred is like a cancer and it transcends all boundaries, religious, ethnic, national. It's contagious, spreading from one person or community to another, always ending in more hatred and destruction. When I brought together thinkers and activists to explore issues confronting humanity, I called the conferences the anatomy of hate, because we were trying to understand the sources of human hatred and how to respond to it. One thing we have learnt: when you face evil, don't let it grow, fight it right away. To be human is to share a common origin. And if we share a common origin, our destinies are intertwined. What happens, such beautiful words. He says, what happens to me will eventually happen to you. What happened to my people is a foreshadowing of what will threaten the world. Auschwitz led to Hiroshima and who knows what else. And then he goes into a very, very famous verse in the Torah. So just before we do, let's just summarize this. We need to know what hatred is, and we need to know also hatred is an inherent disease and it's very contagious. Living through this time now, we understand the concept of something being contagious. Something you have to protect yourself from, something you have to wear a mask against, something you have to socially distance from. Hatred can happen to anyone. It can happen, as we'll see later, it can happen to the best families, it can happen to the best people. Bullying can take place in schools with people who you'd least expect it. It can become a mob mentality. It can spread so quickly, and that's why it's so important to stand up to it, so important to notice it and to fight against it in whatever way. It could be with inspiration, it could be with words, it could be by standing up, depending on what position you're in. But we have to speak up, And we have to not let it happen, because if we let it happen, it spreads. And he goes in, Elie Wiesel goes further, and he talks about a very famous verse in the Torah. And the famous verse is, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, which means, do not stand by on the blood of your friend. Which literally means, if you see someone drowning, you have to save them. If you see someone in a dangerous position, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, you've got to get involved, you've got to try and help them. But it doesn't only mean when someone is in physical danger, right? It means when someone is subject to humiliation, someone is subject to trauma, someone is subject to hatred, to bullying, to any form of aggression. It could be someone in an abused relationship. It can be a kid in school who's being mistreated. It can be becoming an advocate. It can be bullying. It can be the way we treat our own children, the way we treat our friends, the way we see friends treating other friends, whatever it is. We are not permitted to stand silent. We need to notice, understand what it is, know how to tell the difference between strong conflict and hatred. Two different things. And not to stand by idly. You know, because when the Torah talks about, I was just discussing this with someone yesterday, and recently I did a series on the Jewish perspective to mental health and some of the various early sources about mental illness and so on and so forth. And I was quoting, I was sharing with them this talk I gave, and I was telling them one of the most fascinating sources that I came across was a Tosfot. And this is 12th century stuff, 12th century writings, where it's not relevant now, the whole context, but Tosfot, one of the commentators in the Talmud, makes the following observation and says that emotional pain is worse than physical pain. Similar to what the Talmud says, that embarrassing someone, humiliating someone is like murder. Right? And if someone is subject to that type of trauma, it's like being subject to violence, or it could turn into violence. And we need, as people, as activists, as we say in this chapter, not world activists, but activists around us, to notice it, to have empathy, and to do something about it. Do something about it varies from situation to situation, but we need to be able to do something about it. And he makes an interesting observation. He says that the word re'echa means your friend, another human being. That what the Torah is telling us is that what happens to another human being is our responsibility. It's the concept of social responsibility. We cannot turn the blind eye. We cannot just turn away. If we notice, we should notice things, and when we notice them in our own way, within our own capabilities, in the context of our limitation, we need to feel responsible. That's what it is. We need to feel responsible. And to highlight this point that hatred can happen anywhere, Elie Wiesel goes back to the very first story of aggression in the Torah, where Cain slays Abel. Cain kills Hevel. And there's so many lessons learned from that. One is the breakdown of communication. The Pasuk says that Cain and Hevel were jealous. Cain was jealous of Hevel because they both brought sacrifices. God accepted the sacrifice of Hevel but rejected that of Cain. Jealousy, again, insecurity, ego. He says he meets Hevel in the field. And it says, and it's a very interesting verse, it says, and Cain said to Hevel, and then it just says he killed him. It doesn't say what he said to him. And one of the interpretations is that it was just a total breakdown of communication. There was no communication. Communication, effective communication, can help fix things, but not when there's no communication. And then he gets up and he kills him. And Elie Wiesel makes the point. He says, where did Cain grow up? Was it the parents' fault? Was it their parenting? Obviously not. It was a new set of parents. He didn't grow up in a dysfunctional home. He was the son of the first man and woman. Hadn't been around for that long. He was just part of the human condition. And God created every human with an ego. He created all of us with our insecurities. He created us with a soul to overcome it, to combat it, to fight it. But he did create us with an ego. We've talked about this many, many times. So the possibility of hate lies within every single one of us. The possibility to be so insecure to the point of causing division and putting someone else down to make ourselves strong, which is often the source of hatred. We make ourselves strong by putting someone else down. The bully in the school is often an insecure person. He needs help as much as the victim does. But it's wrong, and we have to stand up to it. No tolerance to it. Why? Because he wants to make someone else small, so that he can be big or she can be big. Right? So Cain and Hevel, there was no background to it. There was no dysfunctional home. There was no substance abuse. There was no anything. Just a human being. And a human being, unfortunately, has the potential to be aggressive and to hate. And then the final lesson we learn, again, going back to the concept of responsibility. We all have a responsibility. Is the famous words. The famous words that God calls out to Cain and says, Aye Hevel Achicha, where is Hevel your brother? To which Cain responds those famous words, Am I my brother's keeper? And the answer to that is, yes, you are. And we all are. That's part of responsibility. We are all each other's keeper. We all need to look out. We all need to notice someone who's in distress. We all need to notice someone who's the subject of hate. We all need to notice a perpetrator of hate and stand up to them. We all need to notice. We all need to be responsible. Incidentally, a contrast to what Cain said, am I my brother's keeper, we can find by another person, the opposite, who we need to learn from. The story of Yosef. Yosef had a conflict with his brothers. His brothers hated him. They hated him. They made a mistake, but he didn't hate them. He didn't fight hatred with hatred. And his brothers went to look after the sheep. This was the prelude to him being sold. And what happens is, his father says to him, can you go to Shechem, where the brothers were, and look what's happening with my flock? And he says, of course I'm going to go. And he goes, and on the way he can't find his brothers. And someone finds him, an ish, a man, which Rashi and the commentators tell us was an angel. And the angel says, what are you looking for? You seem lost. Where are you going? And Joseph, who was the epitome of someone who wasn't a victim, someone who never hated, someone who never bore a grudge, someone who never fought hate with hate, as we know, we've talked about this many times. You know what the words, and I saw this explanation in one of Rabbi Jacobson's articles. Beautiful, beautiful thing. He says, what does Yosef respond? He says to the person, the angel, whoever had met him, he says, Achai anochi mevakesh. I'm looking for my brothers. Meaning, on a deeper level, not just, you know, I'm lost, have you seen my brothers? Do you know the address? He says, I'm looking for my brothers. Meaning, I feel responsible. I want to change their hearts. I'm not looking to hate them. I'm not looking to take revenge. I'm looking for my brothers, the exact opposite of Cain. So the lesson of what not to be is what Cain said. Cain said, Hashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? The answer is yes, we all are brother's keepers. And we learn that from Yosef, who even when was in great conflict with his brother, he says, Es achai anochi mevakesh. I'm looking for my brother. We have a responsibility to look out for other people, to behave in ways which will affect other people positively, to remember to save other people, to stand up on behalf of other people, to stand up to people who are perpetrating evil. We have that responsibility. It's not a responsibility that we can abdicate. We don't have to be an activist worldwide. We don't have to change the world, but we have to do it within our own context, within our own environments. Now, we said before, and I just want to make this clear, and this is an important point, something that Elie Wiesel himself brings up in the chapter. Because we said we cannot fight hate with hate. However, that doesn't mean that we never fight it with strength, depending on the context. Sometimes we need strength. Sometimes we need justice to eliminate evil from the world. Sometimes we even need to report people who are perpetrating evil and have them brought to justice so that evil is not in the community. Sometimes we have to stand up. A school has to sometimes be very assertive and send a very, very strong message to a perpetrator of hate, to a bully, to whatever the case is. Society needs to do that. We need to do that with our own children sometimes. Sometimes we have to be firm. Sometimes we have to be unpopular. Sometimes there even has to be war. War is not always immoral. War is sometimes moral. Self-defense or whatever the case is. Or to take away evil. Sometimes there has to be punishment. But it doesn't mean that there should be aggression and hate, and they're two different things. You know, I'll just quote for you something that Elie Wiesel says in this chapter. Professor Wiesel, he says, returns to Dave's question. He says, you asked whether words are enough. Now, Elie Wiesel's main weapon of activism was words. talking, lobbying, inspiring, telling stories, teaching. But he says sometimes they are not. When it came to Bosnia, with a heavy heart, I supported the US and NATO decision to go to war in order to stop the mass rape, murders, and deportations. Otherwise, how can I complain of the world's silence in my time? I don't want people to ask our generation, why were you silent? We cannot allow killers to get away with it. It is intolerable whenever it happens. So we speak, we write. But when innocent people are dying, sometimes we must also act. So I want to share with you an idea which clarifies this and makes it so important. So part of activism on any level, part of standing up to hatred, sometimes means strong action. Sometimes means standing up to strong people. Sometimes means taking very, very disciplinary action when or bringing people or exposing people, disciplinary action, so that they're not able to perpetrate evil if there's no other choice. But it depends how it's done, and I want to share with you a couple of thoughts. There's a story in the Chumash when Jacob is coming back after 20 years having run away from his brother Esau, who hated him and wanted to kill him. He comes back and he sends some messengers, angels, to check out Esau's mindset, Esau's mindset. And they come back and they say to Yaakov, yes, Esau is aware that you're coming back to Israel. He's coming to greet you with 400 soldiers. He's all out war. He hasn't forgotten anything. Some people find it very hard to let go of hate. So Yaakov doesn't want to fight, but he does three things. He appeases Esau and he sends him a whole bunch of presents. He tries that. He prays to God. That's also important. And then, if all else fails, he prepares for war. And then he turns to God and he prays. But the first, the Chumash says the following. The Chumash says, Vayira Yaakov me'od. Yaakov was very afraid. Vayetzer le, and he was very distressed. He was afraid and distressed. So the commentaries say, every word in the Chumash is so exact. What does it mean he was afraid and he was distressed? Why can't we just have one of them? He was distressed or he was afraid. So the Talmud says the following. Listen to this carefully. The Talmud says, he was afraid that he might be killed. He was distressed because he might have to kill. If Yaakov would come to the point where he had to fight a war against Esav, if Yaakov would come to the fact where he had to even kill one of Esau's family in self-defense, it would be perfectly moral, 1,000% legitimate. But he would be distressed. He doesn't want to kill. To want to kill is very bad. To want to punish is very bad. To want to be aggressive is very bad, even when it's legitimate. Because human life is always precious, even with an evil person. The human spark, the human dignity is always present, even in the most evil of people. And to want to kill is not a good thing. To kill sometimes is a moral obligation, but to want to kill isn't. Let me translate this on a very sort of more simple level. When I was in high school, I'll tell you this personal story, I've never forgot this. This is what kind of impression it made on me. When I was in high school, we had a principal. I don't mind even saying his name because I had a lot of respect for him. His name was Rabbi Pollack. A few years ago, he passed away. He was living in England. He was a master educator. We all loved him. He was a small yeshiva. We absolutely loved him. We respected him. We revered him. We loved him. He was an amazing educator. He spent time with us. He told us stories. He guided us. He was a mentor. He was an amazing person. And he was very strict because it was no nonsense. He had to come on time to class. He had to come on time to school. It was, you know, he was strict. But most of the time, he didn't have discipline problems because we just revered him. Sometimes he did, and he had his famous little punishments that he would give. We had to write out certain verses of the Torah, and so on and so forth. But, you know, and he was strict with it. It was no nonsense. He had to do it, and that was it. Now, when I was in high school, and I'm sure many of you were in your high school, the culture was that you hit someone. Teachers hit students once in a while. He hardly, and that was considered acceptable in those times. He hardly ever did it. He once or twice threatened with it, but he didn't do it. In all my time of high school, he once did it. And I remember the scene very, very clearly. I remember we were sitting around it was like an assembly or something, or he was teaching a class, and there was one particular boy, and I remember his face still, I've forgotten his name, and he was problematic, and he was extremely disrespectful and disruptive, and it was not good. And he asked him a few times to stop, and eventually this person became extremely disruptive, extremely disrespectful. Rabbi Pollack got really upset, walked over to him, and gave him, as we call in Yiddish, a porpech, which means a couple of them, and we were all pretty shocked. He walked back to his place, he continued the lesson. That's not the part of the story that I want to share with you. Part of the story I want to share with you is, for the next few weeks, he was upset. He was upset, and we could see him every recess, every lunchtime. You know, sometimes when he wanted to talk to one of our students, it was a beautiful garden that the school had. He would take the students, he would walk up and down, he would mentor and talk and explain. And, you know, we all got that once in a while. We used to enjoy those. And we saw him up and down for like 2 weeks, talking to this boy, inspiring this boy, mentoring the student, lifting him up. And I remember we were talking about it amongst ourselves. One person said, yes, Rabbi Pollack was really hurt that he had to give him a smack. He felt that he had to, but he was so hurt by it. And he loved that student. He did it out of love. He did it because he really had to, and expressed it, and that's why he won back that boy. He won back that student. Sometimes you have to go to war, but you mustn't want to have to war. They tell a story about one of the great sages in the last generation. He lived in Israel, from the Lithuanian origin. His name was the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish used to advise sometimes educational leadership. And the Chazon Ish always used to warn schools that you've got to be very, very careful before you expel a child, because if you expel a student, you never know what can happen. It could have a lasting effect on that person. However, sometimes there's not a choice. So a principal came to him and said, there's no choice, this kid is ruining the school. Disruptive, literally, ruining the school. There's a concept even in halakha of yachid v'rabim. If it's an individual versus a majority, versus a community, then the community wins. There's no choice. We've tried everything. There's no choice. This kid has to go. And the Chazon Ish told him, okay, you're asking me a question. I'm going to give you permission to expel this child on one condition. On one condition. And the condition is that you need to tell this child that you are prepared to learn with him one-on-one a few times a week after school. Because you cannot do this by abandoning the child, as bad as he is. You got to do it for the benefit of the school, but you got to hate doing it. You got to hate expelling the child. So much so that you got to demonstrate that you love him and you care for him and you still have a responsibility. The school maybe can't take him, but the community has a responsibility for him. And therefore you have to learn with him and you have to win him back on some level. Very, very powerful. There are many stories like that, but we're running out of time. There are times that we have to be harsh. There are times we have to be strong. There are times we have to stand up and be unpopular. But we need, even against those that are perpetrating evil, we have to not want to do it. We have to do it because we have to do it, because it's a responsible thing to do. So let's come back to the beginning. So let's just summarize. Activism doesn't mean that we change the world. Activism means that we have to care, notice, and talk about things. We have to do what we can in our environment. The people around us, noticing the people around us, whether it's our children, our friends, people that we know, noticing people who seem to be in distress, noticing people who are subject to hate, not turning a blind eye, noticing the person in the community who's suffering an abusive relationship, noticing people who are going through any type of distress or subject to any type of aggression or abuse, and helping them, not judging them, staying away from judgmentalism, standing up against bigotry, against hatred, against division, against judgmentalism, and taking responsibility. Activism means that we have to feel responsible. It could mean doing one more thing in the next week, but we have to feel that sense of responsibility. Don't say it's nothing to do with me. It has got to do with me. It's all got to do with each of us. One step at a time. That's the lesson that comes out of this, that we need to understand what hatred looks like. We need to be able to tell the difference between assertiveness, healthy division or healthy conflict, and senseless hatred that comes from ego and aggression. We have to stay away from it ourselves as much as we possibly can, run away from it, and stand up to it when we see it, feel responsible, notice things, and change things one at a time. It could be through talking about it. It could be by a preventative method of inspiring others and making a part of the conversation with people, with children, with friends, with colleagues, with students, with people that we know, and so on and so forth. I'll just end off with a little story that he brings in the book. He says, Professor Wiesel used to like to tell these Hasidic stories. I've shared this with you before. So he tells a story about the Kotzke Rebbe. He's one of his favorites, obviously. And he said, a student once asked the famed Rebbe of Kotzk. He said, why did it take God 6 days to create the world? Look at it. It's filled with corruption, cruelty, inhumanity. The master replied, can you do better? The disciple said, I think yes I can. So the Kotzke Rebbe said, so what are you waiting for? Get started. Go to work immediately. You know, sometimes we talk about being against hatred or evil or bad things and so on and so forth. And we krecht, you know, we say, oh, what a terrible thing. People are looting shops in America. What a terrible thing. People are hating and then, I don't know, somewhere else. And then we go on with our meal and our conversation and so on and so forth. Being an activist coming out of this chapter does not mean just krechting, giving a big kvetch and say, oh, you know, it's so terrible that, look what's happening to that person. But deep down what we're thinking is, it's so terrible what's happening to that person, but it's got nothing to do with me. When we notice something that's not good, when we notice something that's negative, let's not just kvetch about it, like the disciple kvetched about God's world. Obviously, the Kotzke Rebbe was being sharp, you know, you can't ask questions on God, but he says, that's not the point anyway. If you've got a problem with the world, so fix it. You think you can do a better job, so fix it. Start doing something good, start today. Start noticing someone. Start connecting to someone. Start standing up for someone. Start making it part of the conversation. And I think the important thing for us to know is that we can never know, and we say this all the time, but it's so important. We can never know what effect we can have on one person and what effect we can have on the global community and what effect we can have through a ripple effect. Before we talked about this concept of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa, Not to stand by idly when someone is suffering. When someone is suffering, it's not only them that is suffering. The commentaries explain you have to look at a person as an entire universe, even on a very simple level, because that person has friends, that person has children, that person will have future generations. If that person suffers, a lot of other people suffer. When we save one person, when we help one person, we're helping a lot of people. When we're helping one person, we're creating a culture of tolerance, we're getting a culture of love, we're getting a culture of compassion and kindness. Every act that we do is an entire world. So we should never think, what's difference is going to make my one little thing? Because everything we do is just absolutely incredibly powerful, because we never know the ripple effect and how far it could go. And that's maybe some of the lessons that we can pick up from this chapter, to feel that responsibility, to notice, and to, in our way, try and do something about it. Thank you all for listening. Again, it's 2 more weeks of this series. We're going to do 2 more chapters, beautiful chapters. And then we'll take a little break after that and come on to something else. So wishing everyone a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're
welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Welcome. Good to see you. Okay, I'm going to end the meeting. All the best, everyone. See you. Good to see
Thanks,
you, Harry.
Rabbi.
All the best.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.